Greg Wills' travels to Washington, his awkward approach to Teresa Whelan at the Pentagon, and his unsolicited telephoning of oil companies' lobbying offices suggested a strain of amateurism in the plot, at odds with Mann's records of corporate security success during the 1990s. The plan had several prongs. An undercover team led by a South African named Nick Dutois infiltrated Malabo in late 2003 in the guise of businessmen. They set up a firm called Triple Option and claimed to be interested in fishing. In fact, they carried out reconnaissance and prepared to aid the coup team when it landed at the airport. The main external raiding party would be made up of veteran soldiers from South Africa and Angola. They would streak into Malabo from Southern Africa in a transport plane, seize the airport, and then roll toward the presidential palace to capture or kill Obiang. As Dutois later described it, the advance group and the arriving mercenaries would meet at Malabo's airport and then drive to Obiang's palace, kidnap the president, and then systematically kill all other Equato-Guinean ministers. Obiang would be exiled to Spain, and a plane would arrive carrying Severo Moto and his supporters to form a new government. Dutois would be paid either $1 million or $5 million. There are documents reporting both numbers, if the coup succeeded. Mark Thatcher, the son of Margaret Thatcher, the Cold War-era conservative Prime Minister of Britain, lent the group funds, although he said later that he had been misled about the purpose of his loan and had no idea it was to be used in support of a coup d'état. Soldiers clued in on the plan in South Africa and Equatorial Guinea spoke so loosely about their plans that the British government picked up coup rumors simply by monitoring Africa's radio services. When Obiang visited South Africa in December 2003, his hosts passed intelligence that he should be watchful. Angola's government passed him warnings as well. The intelligence was accurate. The coup makers had moved toward a strike that winter. Obiang traveled to the United States in February on one of his regular private visits. Apart from his occasional medical treatment, he seemed to enjoy spending time in America. And he checked into the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, a modern brown brick building on the southeastern edge of cobblestoned Georgetown. On a gray Monday afternoon, five executives arrived from Riggs, Obiang's principal bank, whose branch across from the White House had first attracted the president's attention as a place where he might store his oil wealth while deepening ties to American corridors of power. Equatorial Guinea's deposits now totaled about $750 million, by far the largest of any of the bank's clients. Auditors from the regulatory office of the Comptroller of the Currency were crawling all over Riggs that winter, however. A probe had been sparked by other accounts held at Riggs for Saudi Arabia's embassy in Washington and for the former Chilean dictator, Augusto Pinochet. The regulators were now asking questions about Equatorial Guinea's accounts. They had recently raised concerns about offshore transactions in the accounts controlled by Obiang. Riggs and its management could face fines or worse if they did not come up with convincing answers. At the Four Seasons, the bank's delegation announced that it was particularly focused on several relatively modest wire transfers, totaling less than $1 million, to offshore companies that appeared to be linked to Simon Careri, the Riggs account executive who serviced Obiang. Obiang waved them off. "The transactions were authorized to support the economic development of his country," he said vaguely. He refused to be drawn on specifics. When the bankers pressed, Obiang sent one of his sons, Gabriel, along with several aides, to go off and review the matter. The two delegations bundled into cars and rolled over to Pennsylvania Avenue. Inside the columned Riggs branch, Gabriel looked over the records and explained that some of the transactions involving Careri had been authorized, but at lesser amounts than had actually been transferred to the offshore accounts. This raised the possibility that someone, possibly Careri, had been skimming money. The Riggs executives asked what the offshore companies receiving funds actually did. Gabriel was vague. The bankers warned him that if he could not provide specific, verifiable descriptions of what the money sent offshore had been used for, Riggs might have to end its entire relationship with Equatorial Guinea, notwithstanding the great financial pain it would cause the bank. In the post-September 11 world, it was unacceptable for American banks to host accounts making international wire transfers to unknown front companies, they explained. Nobody was suggesting that Equatorial Guinea was financing terrorists, but the rules were inviolable. Gabriel declined to explain. The transfers were authorized by the government to pay for services, he said. That afternoon, Riggs's Risk Management Committee met to terminate the bank's relationship with Obiang. The bank's executives announced that $40 million in Obiang's accounts, an amount equal to the balance of his outstanding loans, would be frozen pending resolution of the debts. The rest of his funds, about $700 million altogether, would be released in the form of cashier's checks, which authorized individuals, including the president himself, would be free to pick up at the branch across from the White House so they could hand-carry the checks to another bank of their choice for deposit.